My guest for this episode of Orphan Radio is Gary Jenkins. He's a retired Kansas City, Missouri police officer, and he has a new documentary film out called Gangland Wire about the history of the Kansas City Mafia.
Can you tell me about your new documentary, Gangland Wire, the background behind it, and why you chose to make the film?
I made Gangland Wire because I was a young detective in the Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit. I was assigned to work a case with the FBI, and we started following some of the local mobsters around. We have a La Cosa Nostra, Sicilian, rooted organized crime family in Kansas City, there was a mob war going on at the time, and my job as part of it was to follow a couple of people around and try to keep them from getting killed, basically, because there were contracts out on them, and we wanted to try to interrupt it or maybe catch somebody in the act, and that didn't really work, but we never did catch anybody because they seemed like they always spotted us. But as part of that, we developed some probable cause with the FBI to put a microphone in a tavern called the Villa Capri, and they started listening to that hidden microphone, and they started hearing evidence or hear talk about casinos and Las Vegas and lots of money and the Teamsters, and they spun off to some other wires, and they ended up uncovering skim coming from Las Vegas. We actually arrested one of the couriers at the end of the investigation after 9-10 months of wiretaps and bugs and surveillance, interviewing witnesses and turning people into witnesses, or interviewing sources and turning people into witnesses. And they took $40,000 off of this guy, and he took $80,000, and that was a 2-month take from the Tropicana alone, and there was other money going to Chicago. Mm-hmm. So and they made the movie Casino. It was based on this investigation and what was uncovered in this investigation, and I wanted to tell the real story, and I had some of the real witnesses. I was able to go to the FBI and get copies of the audio tapes that were placed as evidence in this trial. You can do that under Title III of the United States Code. Once all chances for appeal have been exhausted, you can get any evidence that was placed before the court during the trial. And so all chances for appeal were gone. All the defendants were dead. So I was able to obtain those audio tapes, and part of my film, Gangland Wire, I'm able to tell how the Midwest mob worked out of the mouths of the mobsters as they sit around discussing how to steal from the casinos. They sit around discussing who's snitching, who isn't. They discuss codes on when they were going to have something shipped in on an airplane, how they were going to tell them and what the code was, and a variety of things like that.
Mm-hmm. So what years were you working on this investigation?
This mob war started over an entertainment district called the River Key in close to downtown Kansas City. And that really started in 1971. And they started battling around 74, 75 over some parking lot money and parking lot rights to lose parking lots. And so in 76, when I went to the intelligence unit, they had just really started this mob war. And this carried on until about 78, when we finally served the search warrants, I believe, and then the trials weren't until 81. They didn't really stop the scam. We continued to work, and they were still trying to kill one guy here in Kansas City that was left of the opposing faction of the Savella family, and so we continued to work on this really up until early 80s.
Okay. So what was organized crime in Kansas City like back then?
Now, at that point in time, that was kind of like the peak of their covert power, maybe not the peak. Was probably more like right around at the end of Prohibition, and just before, and maybe even on through to right after the war. In the 50s, they had a lot of political contacts. They didn't have the money that they had in the power outside of Kansas City until the 70s, and we had a family that was just like Vito Corleone and the Godfather. They tell the same story. Italian immigrants came here in the 1914, after the Irish had immigrated in the later 1800s and throughout the Civil War, and the next big wave was from around Southern Europe, and Italians were the biggest group that came in, and they brought this La Cosa Nostra, mocked criminal activity, criminal gang with them. And, you know, they started out preying on other Italian shopkeepers. And actually, Nick Favella, who rose to be the boss all from the early 50s until he died in the in 1982, I think, just before the trials, for the skimming before the skimming trials, he actually was kind of on the outs with the old-time, what they call mustache pizza, the old-line black hand table, because they had actually extorted money from his father, who was a shopkeeper. And he started robbing some of their protected gangs, and then they tried to kill him. And he went off to Chicago and got protected up there, and finally negotiated a deal, and he came back, and he started rising up through the ranks, and then he became the driver for the boss, a man named Tony Gizzo, in the early 50s. And Tony Gizzo died, and he moved into that position. And so, you know, he had an underboss, Tuffy DeLuna, in the 70s, who handled all the day-to-day activities. Tuffy was the guy that went out to Las Vegas and straightened things out for the Chicago, Cleveland, and Milwaukee mobs, as well as Kansas City, in regard to the scheme.
So where were they around town? Like, where were their, you know, the places they hung out and their headquarters and things like that?
Well, they had anybody that pays much attention to the mafia and reads the headlines, and like John Gotti had the Rabbinite Social Club, and they always have in these old line Italian neighborhoods, there's always a social club where they drink coffee and play cards, and people meet, and both mobsters and non mobsters, and they'll meet up. It'll be kind of the headquarters of the mob, and used to see them. It was like a movie. They'd be hanging around out front, talking and wearing Sansa belt slacks and pullover polo shirts, golf shirts, and so that was at Fifth and Troost, which is what we call the North End. It's called the Northview Social Club, and then that was only about 10 blocks or less from the city market. And Italians had historically, they went in the produce business when they got here and had grocery stores and push carts and other businesses associated with produce. And so they hung out at the city market a lot. Mm-hmm. And there's a clip of my movie where the brother, the consigliere to the boss, Nick Savella, his brother, Carl Savella, is being interviewed by the local news, and he's complaining of being down to the city market. He's complaining about how the police, meaning me and some of the FBI agents and some of my fellow officers in the intelligence unit, were cruise around the market. They write down your license number, and they follow you here, and they follow you there. He said basically a waste of the taxpayers' money. So that's where the two places that you can find them pretty quick.
Mm-hmm. So if they hadn't gotten into this kind of dispute with each other, do you think that there's a chance that still might be going on today, or do you think that they kind of went down the tubes with the rest of the Italian mob, like around the country?
Probably they would have. The whole thing would have gone down the tubes sooner or later. That just started a little sooner in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a huge amount of public pressure on the FBI and the Kansas City Police, and we donated a lot of resources and put a lot of resources into it and this mob war in the River Tee, because it was just really nice. It was like the crossroads in Kansas City today. It's this really nice, comfortable family atmosphere that people were coming back in from the suburbs, because they were really fleeing to the suburbs in the early 70s and late 60s. Mm-hmm. They were coming back in and eating in restaurants and drinking in the bars and shopping in the old art stores, and there's a lot of artists down there, and they just, you know, this mob war just destroyed that. And so there was a lot of pressure on us to solve this, and we were trying to solve it when we found the information on the Las Vegas skimming.
And I know, you know, going over your website and things like that, like, I know you were in intelligence, so
right.
Planning a bug, is there kind of an art form to that, planning a bug, like in somebody's headquarters or car or something like that?
It's a pretty big operation, because back then it was even bigger. Now they've got much more cooler technology. There's a laser gun. They can just aim at your window, and the window becomes the amplifier, and the laser beam picked up the sound and takes it back to some kind of a recording device. And so back then, you had to basically, to plant a hidden microphone, you had to get in to the place, and you wanted to have it hardwired, we'd call hardwired. You didn't want to depend on wireless, because the wireless wasn't any good at all, really. So you had to, you know, if it's a house or a business, you had to find out all the habits of the people that lived there or would be there, business when they were open, and if anybody come back in, was there a burglar alarm? So you had to do a real intensive survey and then figure out when you could get in. Now, actually getting in, the burglar alarm, if there was one back then, was pretty easy to defeat, and especially when you can get on the phone lines, and if the burglar alarm phoned out, like, they could handle that pretty easily, and they could handle a burglar alarm. So it wasn't, a lot of things weren't a burglar alarm, and they weren't alarmed up back then as they are now, so that wasn't much of an issue. And lockpick, they had a guy that comes in from, flies all around the United States back then, who was an expert at picking locks. And they just take a picture of the lock, and then he'd go buy one just like it when he came in, and he'd learn how to pick that real quick. But the night that you did it, you wanted to figure out how you got the people who might supposed to be there out, or the business, you'd wait till they were closed, and somebody'd follow them home, then they'd sit on them. You'd have a whole surveillance crew on that business owner who might come back in. And then, you know, later on in the night, you'd go in and pick the lock and get in and go to work. And then you'd always keep some uniformed guys around. One of our guys usually did not wear uniforms. So that night, they would put on uniforms and go check out a marked car, a couple of them, and just cruise the area in case somebody called in on a prowler call, or they did accidentally set off a hidden alarm that you didn't know about, or the owner's friend would all of a sudden come in and barge in on the middle of them. It was just a big operation. It took a lot of work. And the wiretaps were easy because you just take the piece of paper to the phone company and they would identify the line quite a ways away from where the place was. You just get on the line then.
So what are some other, throughout your career in the Kansas City Police Department, were there some other like big cases or more interesting things that you worked on for a while besides the Italian mob?
Well, you know, one night I came back to the intelligence unit as a sergeant, and we were working, the ATF got hold of us. At the time, it was when the public cable TV, Time Warner, first started their cable TV, and they had to dedicate the public access channel, and so anybody could go put something on the public access channel. So the Ku Klux Klan, they had a small group of them here in the city, and then there was a bigger group that was more like the mother group out of Oklahoma. There are these twin brothers named Dennis and I think Michael Mahan. And Dennis ended up getting convicted of planting a bomb on somebody down in Phoenix. So they were going to do the local Klan and this Midwest Klan out of Oklahoma and some skinheads out of Oklahoma, and they went Rigo, I think was his name. They were going to do a public access television show for the Klan. And so the local Klan guy, the local wizard or whatever he was, he had a little different robe. He had like a satiny kind of red robe, while most of them were wearing white, would wear white robes. Mm-hmm. So he was going to get on there and, you know, give the Klan philosophy that night. And so we started watching them, and we watched them go down and train and kind of identify who was all involved, and then we knew the night they were going to do it. So we got it set up all around there, mainly because we were afraid that anti-Klan people would show up and there would be violence. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they didn't show up, but some of our guys, the Klan put out a pickup truck with two guys just driving around watching the outside perimeter. And so we stopped them, and they took two guns and a taser and some clubs off of them. And about that time, some other guy came flying up and jumped out of his car, and one of the guys that was sitting in the van saw him take a gun out and stick it in his belt. So they jumped out and grabbed him and got him with a carrying concealed weapon. And then the other Klan guys had finished their show, and so they take off, and they realize that some of their members have been caught by the police with guns, and so they all start running back to their cars. And so we end up grabbing them all up and taking about 3 or 4 more guns out of their cars and take them all in. I think we ended up with 2 CCW charges out of it. We covered about 10 guns off of them and some other weapons like that. So that was a lot of fun, and it was cool.
What drew you to police work? Why did you decide to become a police officer?
Oh, you know, I grew up in the 50s, and in the 50s, and if you're a boy, it was Lone Ranger and all the cowboy shows and all the westerns. And you know, when I grew up, I just wanted to have a gun and a horse and ride around and save people. And so, you know, they didn't have any horses anymore. But I learned about the police department by watching, you know, more TV, and I thought, you know, that's the deal for me. That's the closest I get to it. So I became a policeman. Instead of a horse, they gave me a 1971 Plymouth Fury, and instead of a lever action 30-30, they gave me a 12-gauge shotgun, and instead of a 45 Colt, they gave me a 38 Smith & Wesson, and I got to ride around and save people, or at least take their police reports.
So how is, I know the movie's showing it at Screenland Crown Center, and how has the reaction been to it?
Oh, it's good. It's been fantastic. There, people in there are just really happy with the crowd that we've been getting. You know, the first couple of nights when we had a lot of publicity, it was pretty close to being sold out. And ever since then, it's just steady that every day, you know, even like last night, a really cold night, or during the Chiefs, we had... I think we had 14 or 15 during the Chiefs, and it's freezing last night. We had an equal amount last night, and I've been going over, attending every screening, and answering questions afterwards, and telling a few more stories to kind of stir this up. Of course, I had the DVD for sale, and I'm trying to make a little money back on the money I put out for doing this.
I know you. This isn't the first movie you've made. I know you've made a few documentaries. What are some future ones that you're thinking about possibly doing?
So, you know, right now I'm just kind of focusing on this. I had a man during the making of the story of the Underground Railroad, and then I made the one about Negroes to Hire, about Slave Life in Missouri. And one of my experts said he knew where there was an archive with quite a little bit of information, images about black troops in World War I, and that's kind of an untold story. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of pushing me to that. Now, that's kind of interesting. There's a couple of police stories that I thought about telling. I remember this one deal back in the early 70s, late 60s. There was a little plot to kidnap Muriel Kaufman, and it came out, and it was a cool story, but I can't seem to find anybody that remembers anything much about it. So there's a few other police stories that I've thought about telling, like when the LA gangs all moved to Kansas City. I was assigned to the LA gang task force, and I had a tactical response team, and they needed a group of SWAT guys to just be assigned to narcotics and work on these guys, and that was kind of an interesting story too. So I don't know, those are some stories that I've mulling over in my mind.
So what happened with that? Was there just too much, like, were they under too much pressure out in LA, so they all started coming here?
Right. There, you know, there was an overabundance of drugs and drug sellers for the market out there. And it was very violent out there at that time. And so these guys, you know, they all had relatives and connections in other cities. And it was a kind of a phenomenon. I taped not like 60 minutes, but 48 hours of those kinds of shows. And they came back here and interviewed us about it. But down in Texas and Denver but Seattle and Portland and a lot of those middle-sized cities, they were where there was not, like Chicago had these hugely organized gang populations up there. It's hard to move in, but we weren't organized like that in Kansas City. It's kind of an open market, and same way with Seattle and Portland and down in Texas, like Fort Worth, and kind of middle-sized cities. You know, they just flogged in and set up, and we finally, it was really interesting. We got a tip. I think the Bureau got the tip. This guy was coming in with several kilos on the Amtrak. There's an overnight Amtrak that comes from L.A. and goes to Chicago and comes through Kansas City. Gets here, I think, about 7 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning. This guy was coming in, so we went down and started working it. And I went in the bathroom down there, and just because I had to go to the bathroom, and obviously they've been using it because there's this gang graffiti. Somebody's talking about the Inglewood Bloods and on the walls. And it's like, oh, my God, and we had no idea. And we took this guy off with, like, I don't know, 2 kilos of powder and a couple of kilos of crack cocaine and off that train. So it was a heck of a story.
So when that, is there still a legacy from that? All those gangs coming out here?
Oh, you know, we'd just gone through the whole Jamaican stuff. You know, where a bunch of Jamaicans from back east had moved in and started selling cocaine, set up houses all over the place, and Dave Barton, his narcotics crew, and they had another SWAT team assigned to them, and they pretty much ran them out. And so we put so much pressure on those guys that I remember this one crew who was kind of like more like the upper echelon, and we got right onto their stash house real quick by a stroke of luck, and we served a search warrant on them and arrested two or three of their people, and they all moved out. And we tracked them, and they moved to St. Louis. And I don't know what happened to them in St. Louis, but they kind of, you know, I think probably it set up local people then were able to make connections more directly to Colombians from Kansas City after those guys, because they had connections directly to Colombians, and I kind of saw that happen. Local Kansas Cityans then got direct connection to the source of the cocaine quicker after that.
Well, I know you're retired from the police department, but what do you think are the biggest challenges for the city as far as crime these days?
You know, and I have a different take on this whole drug addiction thing. In my opinion, they just ought to decriminalize the whole thing and make it a medical problem and quit putting people in jail simply for drug crimes. You put them in jail for regular, they may commit crimes in order to get drugs, but I mean, to me, that would solve some problems, but it's a huge political risk, and I might be wrong, you know, so I don't know, but. But drugs is certainly, addiction all across the board is a huge, huge problem. I used to, when I worked dog watch and just in the streets and late at night, and it just, you know, 90% of the calls were all related to alcohol and or drugs and the domestic violence and all that. So that's, you know, and that's not really exactly a law enforcement problem. It's more of a medical problem, but the activity is criminalized, and so law enforcement is right there where the rubber meets the road with those kinds of social problems. I mean, we're the police department's the only visible arm of the government that most people ever see, and so it's, but you're not a social worker, and you've got this mix of medical, legal kind of problems that you're supposed to deal with, and so that's, to me, that's one of the biggest problems we have today. A lot of the rest of the social issues that we have, you know, can't do anything about, but you just do what you can.
Check out ganglandwire.com for more information about the movie and for showtimes.